Good morning to you all. You are all very welcome to Sunday service at St. Stephen's Green Unitarian Church in Dublin. You are welcome whether you're here now in the congregation or whether you're watching on webcam or whether you will listen to the podcast later in the week. My name is Aidan O'Driscoll. I'm a member of the congregation here. And we have a tradition of an open pulpit where every so often, maybe every 4 or 6 weeks, a member of the congregation leads the service with a view to introducing some new voices to the service and also to give our hard-working minister a rest. An opening prayer. This house is for the ingathering of nature and human nature. It is a house of friendships, a haven in trouble, an open room for the encouragement of our struggle. It is a house of freedom, guarding the dignity and worth of every person. It offers a platform for the free voice, for declaring, both in times of security and danger, the full and undivided conflict of opinion. It is a house of truth-seeking, where scientists can encourage devotion to their quest, where mystics can abide in a community of searchers. It is a house of art, adorning its celebrations with melodies and handiworks. It is a house of prophecy, outrunning times past and times present, in visions of growth and progress. This house is a cradle of our dreams, the workshop of our common endeavour. We'll now have our chalice lighting. Life is a gift for which we are grateful. We gather in community to celebrate the glories and mysteries of this great gift. We'll now have our first hymn 21, For the Beauty of the Earth. Let us pray. It's fair to say our thoughts, moods, tones, even colours, for the past months have been autumnal, if not slightly fearful of the winter ahead. But there is a time of hope and celebration ahead. Today is the first Sunday of Advent, and I will recite an Advent prayer. Blessed Creator, who moves in the dark, teach us to hope. Help us to be ready, to appreciate the spark of light that comes to illuminate our hearts and show the way towards love and peace. Help to find the breath to call out injustice, to speak words of love to those in need, to whisper in the wind that there is good in this world and enough to share, in the true belief that someday this world can become a beloved community that holds us all in care. Amen. Our congregation is quietly proud that we have had Sunday worship and a celebration of the divinity in the Unitarian tradition in this church for the past 160 years. The congregation moved here from a meeting house in Eustace Street in the Templar quarter of the city. There is also a Quaker meeting house adjacent, and as a result, a square called Meeting House Square was created that is now a focal point of Temple Bar. So, do Unitarians worship in a meeting house, a chapel, or a church? Well, I'm not sure it really matters, but I am reminded of Philip Larkin's description of a church as a serious house on serious earth in his poem Church Going, written in 1955. In this wonderful poem, Larkin coming across an old disused church, ponders the future of belief and divinity in a secular modern world. He speculates that while churches may well disappear over time, we as human beings will still need what such a sacred space has to offer. I quote the last verse. It pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognized and robed as destinies. And that much never can be obsolete, since someone will forever be surprising a hunger in himself to be more serious, and gravitating with it to this ground, which he once heard was proper to grow wise in, if only that so many dead lie around. Let it be so. Our reader this morning is Alison.
As Aidan said, today is the start of Advent, the official beginning of the preparation for Christmas. And Christmas seems to come earlier every year with all its sparkly paraphernalia. And there are hosts and choirs of angels in all the shop windows, making sure we get the message. Angels are the celestial supernatural beings that are said to bridge the gap between God and people. They are God's messengers. I personally don't believe in these supernatural beings. My preference is for those angels without wings, and some may even have dirty faces. An angel without wings is a metaphor for a kind and supportive person who helps others. They may or may not have a message to give you, and they may only stay for a while. Of course, not all angels are human. There is a meme on the internet. It's a picture of a golden retriever dog and a big tabby cat. The caption underneath reads, "And God said, I will send them without wings so no one suspects they are angels." Now I have a little black tabby cat called Missy, who came to me as a rescue cat 10 years ago with a lot of cat baggage and cat issues. She is fiercely independent, a bit contrary, has trust issues, is food obsessed, and is socially awkward. She would also try the patience of a saint. Now, I'm no saint, so when Missy comes to the back door looking to come in, which is about 10 times a day, I open the door and stand and wait and wait and wait until she is ready to come in and to grace me with her presence. Patience, I say to myself. Missy's message to me is patience. Mary Oliver, the poet, has a poem called Angels, which I will read. You might see an angel any time and anywhere. Of course, you have to open your eyes to a kind of second level, but it's not really hard. The whole business of what is reality and what isn't has never been solved, and probably never will be. So I don't care to be too definite about anything. I have a lot of edges called perhaps, and almost nothing you can call certainty for myself, but not for other people. That's a place you just can't get into, not entirely anyway, other people's heads. I'll just leave you with this. I don't care how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. It's enough to know that for some people they exist and that they dance.
Well, now it's time for the piece of magic that most people have come here for anyway, the children's story. So have we any children who would like to come to the front and better hear what I'm going to say? I particularly like animals, and I like to read stories about animals, and I'm going to read another story about animals this morning. It's from Aesop's Fables. Have you seen these animals before? What are they? Hare and the Tortoise. So The Hare and the Tortoise is the title of my story. The hare was always laughing at the tortoise because he walked so slowly. "Really, I don't know why you bothered to go at all," she sneered. "By the time you get there, it will be all over, whatever it is." The tortoise laughed. "I may be slow," he said, "but I bet I can go to the end of the field before you can. If you want to race, I'll prove it to you." Seeing an easy victory, the hare agreed, and she bounded off as fast as she could go. The tortoise plodded steadily after her. Now, it was the middle of a very hot, sunny day, and it was not long before the hare began to feel a little drowsy. "I think I'll just take a short nap under this hedge," she said to herself. "Even if the tortoise passes by, I'll catch him up in a flash." The hare lay down in the shade and was soon fast asleep. The tortoise plodded on under the midday sun. Much later, the hare awoke. It was later than she had intended, but she looked around confidently. "No sign of old tortoise, I see, but even if I had more than 40 winks." Away she went, running through the short grass and the glowing corn, leaping ditches and brambles with ease. In a very short time, she turned the last corner and paused for a moment to look at the place where the race was to end. There, not a yard from the finishing line, was the tortoise, plodding steadily on, one foot after another, nearer and nearer to the end of the race. With a great bound, the hare sneaked forward, but it was too late. Though she threw herself panting over the line, the tortoise was there before her. "Now do you believe me?" asked the tortoise, but the hare was too out of breath to even reply. Now, what do you think we might learn from that story? Well, I suppose it's a little story about persistence. Slow and steady wins the race. Thank you for coming up. We now have our next hymn, number 135, "How Happy They Are." For my own reading, I'm going to revisit the past. I first read this piece 10 years ago. Indeed, I think it was my first ever reading to the congregation. And I must thank Charlie McCaw, the late husband of Moisey, for his constant encouragement and cajoling to read to the congregation. I certainly would not be standing here today without you, Charlie. So if you're watching from above, thank you. The actual reading was a piece that very much appealed to me at the time. In fact, it still does. That's why I'm going to reread it, by a New York Times columnist called Roger Cohen. He is a columnist, journalist, and author with the New York Times for more than 20 years. He moved about 5 or 6 years ago to take over the Paris Bureau, and he has been writing on European issues since. Indeed, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his articles on the war in the Ukraine. The opinion column that I read out is entitled "Mow the Lawn," and in a sense, it was the encouragement for the address I will later give today. "Mow the Lawn. My youngest child, Adele, graduated from the American School in London this week. She's off to college in California, whence I suspect you will never return. As places go, California is up there. Whenever I'm there, I wonder why I have to leave. Unencumbered by too much past, it offers the sunlight tug of the future. So, dear reader, you find me at a juncture. You put four children through high school, and you find yourself reflecting less on the troubled world order and the post-carbon economy than on the happiness whose pursuit America at its founding declared an inalienable right. The founders were not wrong. It is a self-evident truth that people, whether in creating a new nation or simply beginning a new relationship, seek happiness. That they often go about it in the wrong way does not detract from the sincerity of their quest. Sure as there are acorns beneath the oak tree, people keep rekindling their hopes. In this commencement season, commencement in the US context really is what we call graduation here in Ireland. So in this commencement season, there is inevitably much reflection on the nature of these hopes and how to fulfill them. These tend towards the mawkish. Rather, life is a succession of tasks rather than a cascade of inspiration. An experience that is more repetitive than revelatory, at least on a day-to-day basis. The thing is to perform the task well and find reward even in the mundane. I've no idea if Malcolm Gladwell was onto something with his 10,000-hour rule, the notion that this is the time required for the acquisition of perfected expertise in a particular field. But I am sure that grind is underappreciated in our feel-good culture. So don't sweat the details, but do sweat. I've grown suspicious of the inspirational. It's overrated. I suspect duty, that half-forgotten word, may be more related to happiness than we think. Want to be happy? Mow the lawn, collect the dead leaves, paint the room, do the dishes, get a job, labor until fatigue is in your very bones, persist day after day, be stoical, never whine, think less about the why of what you do than getting it done. Get the column written, start pondering the next. A few years ago, when my son Blaise graduated, I was asked to give the commencement speech at the American school in London. Among other things, I said, everyone has something that makes them tick. The thing is, it's often well hidden. Your psyche builds layers of protection around your most vulnerable traits, which may be very closely linked to your precious essence. Distractions are also external. Money, fame, peer pressure, parental expectations. So it may be more difficult than you think to recognize the spark that is your personal sliver of the divine. But do so. Nothing in the end will give you greater satisfaction. Not wealth, not passion, not faith, not even love. For if, as the poet Rilke wrote, all companionship is but the strengthening of two neighboring solitudes, you have to solve the conundrum of your own solitude. Today, it's not precisely that I would retract any of that speech. Well, maybe a little. It's just I put the emphasis elsewhere. I am less interested in the inspirational hero than I am in the myriad doers of everyday good who would shun the description heroic. Less interested in the exhortation to live your dreams than the obligation to make a living wage. Cohen concludes his column, "In the everyday task at hand, for woman or man, happiness lurks." Most of you in this church will be aware that we set up a government-supported community sponsorship group a few years ago to welcome and help integrate a refugee Afghan family into Ireland. It was, by and large, a successful undertaking, and there is now an extended Afghan family very happily resettled in a Midlands town. The full story is recounted in the March edition of Uskuld, which is also available online. Before having to flee the Taliban, the matriarch of the family, Naheed Bashar Dost, was a distinguished journalist and poet in Afghanistan. Here in Ireland, she continues her artistic and cultural pursuits. Indeed, she has just had a book of poetry published a couple of months ago. I have it here with a picture of her on the cover. Her daughter Angela has translated a number of these poems into English, and I would like to read one to celebrate Naheed's achievement. The poem is called Hope. When they closed the school doors on you and pushed you into the geography of ignorance, I gazed at the sunset through the light of your eyes. But never lose hope. Night does not remain night forever. The darkness of night will turn white again. Sunrise will break in your beautiful eyes, and in the garden of your kind heart, smiles will bloom like flowers. Do not despair. Naheed Bashar Dost. I will now read some prayerful words leading to some moments of reflection in silence, and this will conclude with Doreen playing us a small piece of music. Consider that your task here on earth is to try and lead an authentic, worthwhile, and decent life. In so trying, consider that you might embrace a determined optimism. And during your days on earth, consider that the divine will assail you, whether in the joy of a small kindness, the flight of a bird, a Gregorian chant, or in the quiet doubt of the trier. Let it be so. My address this morning offers some thoughts on happiness and its pursuit. It does so in a skeptical tone and wonders if our expectations and anxieties about happiness are by times excessive, inappropriate, and over the top. Happiness may be elusive, but engagement with the idea is perpetual. Roger Cohen's article, Mow the Lawn, reminds us, it is a self-evident truth that people, whether in creating a new nation or simply beginning a new relationship, seek happiness. That they often go about it in the wrong way does not detract from the sincerity of their quest. But first, a little history. The US Declaration of Independence, adopted in 1774 by the so-called Founding Fathers, explains why the then 13 colonies regarded themselves as independent sovereign states, no longer subject to British colonial and monarchical rule. The Declaration's second sentence reads, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." The idea that a new nation would set down the pursuit of happiness as an aspiring ideal has long fascinated me. My curiosity led me to use AI and ChatGPT to analyze the letters, documents, and exchanges of the committee of the five founding fathers who drafted the Declaration, including John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. A sense of the arguments and intentions become apparent. The pursuit of happiness was not the first choice. Rather, the pursuit of property was an early runner. The problem here was that at the time of writing, the US was a colony of Great Britain and did not actually own any property. The pursuit of abundance was another proposal, but it was felt that that feels a bit too greedy. The suggestion of a pursuit of a national lottery was met with the response that there are many Puritans in the country. So the pursuit of happiness seems to have emerged as a kind of catch-all, one for everyone in the audience solution. By way of a footnote, the founding fathers were wise and savvy individuals who knew that the governance of a new republic would face many challenges. This is deftly shown during the drafting of the US Constitution some 10 years later in 1786, in a famous exchange between Benjamin Franklin and Elizabeth Powell, a prominent member of the Philadelphia upper class and a celebrated socialite. This is Franklin's prescient response to Elizabeth Powell's question, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" "A republic," Franklin replied, "if you can keep it." So, how has the pursuit of happiness served the Great American Project and its citizens? Certainly, the project has produced great abundance and riches, but are all its citizens happy? One wonders. One wonders particularly about the word pursuit. There is strong evidence that the more directly we pursue happiness, the more elusive it becomes. Indeed, the research shows that thinking too much about how to be happy actually backfires and undermines well-being. This is in part because all the thinking consumed requires a fair bit of time and is not in itself enjoyable. The author and cultural critic Ruth Whitman develops this argument in her 2016 book entitled America the Anxious: How Our Pursuit of Happiness is Creating a Nation of Nervous Wrecks. Trying too hard to be happy, downloading mindfulness apps, taking yoga classes, reading self-help books, mostly just stresses us out, she writes. In the same vein, the eminent British philosopher A.C. Grayling remarks in his 2002 book, The Meaning of Things, Applying Philosophy to Life, I quote, "It has been wisely said that the search for happiness is one of the main sources of unhappiness in the world." So if the pursuit and direct search for happiness is of dubious worth, what should we do? Well, do certain supportive things right, and happiness will just happen. For example, study after study shows that good social relationships are the strongest, most consistent predictor of a happy life. Just doing certain things other than the direct pursuit of happiness seems ironically to result in the very elusive happiness being found. Viktor Frankl puts it more elegantly. Viktor Frankl was an Austrian psychiatrist, philosopher, and Holocaust survivor, famous for his 1946 book, Man's Search for Meaning. He explains, "Happiness cannot be pursued. It must ensue. One must have a reason to be happy. Once the reason is found, however, one becomes happy automatically." What he means is that happiness is a byproduct or the result of an interesting and meaningful life. It ensues, not the central goal of your life, some pursuit. So it seems there are a number of things, here meaning activities, beliefs, and routines, that act as a kind of scaffolding that allows happiness to emerge and contentment to be built. So what are these mysterious things? Do we know them? Well, I will now reveal them with the help of the mnemonic Eden. E stands for exercise, D stands for diet, E stands for engagement, N stands for nirvana. Eden provides the necessary scaffolding to enable happiness to ensue. If I'm sounding like I am being a little preachy in the next minute or two, well, I am. Exercise. Get those 7,000 steps done each day. Diet. The best advice is the title of Michael Pollan's book. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Engagement. Join your local tennis club or bowls club. Do some volunteering. Start talking and building up that social capital. Nirvana is a Buddhist word for a transcendent, paradisal state of being. I take nirvana as a proxy for the search for meaning, for the spiritual, for the divine, for the self-reflection necessary to avoid what Socrates calls the unexamined life. Go there. But there is no need for me to preach. I am addressing a congregation that nearly fully, embraces these Eden recommendations. This church is, in its many parts, a happy space in St. Stephen's Green, and let us be happy for this. But what about this everyday task at hand? There is another issue with this happiness lark. We tend to ennoble it and set it on a high pedestal. It is something extraordinary, heroic, remarkable. It is about great marriages, successful careers, world tours, enviable wealth, and so on. Thus, it is no wonder that we, mere workaday mortals, perceive difficulty in mastering the happiness business. But what if happiness could happen in a more lowly, mundane, and everyday setting? Could contentment somehow be interwoven with daily activities? Roger Cohn sees the seeds of happiness in humdrum tasks like mowing the lawn, collecting dead leaves, painting a room, doing the dishes, working until fatigue is in your very bones, and persisting day after day. He concludes, in the everyday task for woman and man, happiness lurks. Linda Sohn, a United Methodist minister and writer living in the US, would surely agree. Last year, she published a heartfelt essay entitled, "The Household Chores You Are Avoiding Are Key to a Deeper Life." Busy with the work of ministry and with a young family, she resented any time spent on daily household tasks such as washing, cleaning, food preparation, and so on. These were all outsourced to some paid help. She felt such work could not be productive for her. However, the opportunity, if not the necessity, to stay at home during COVID led her to a kind of epiphany. The everyday chores and routines began to provide her with a mindful and fruitful space. She came to view this previously tedious work as enriching to both her family and her ministry. At a retreat at a nearby Benedictine monastery, where the monks would do all their own domestic and farm work, she was impressed by the response of a monk who said that their physical labor was a form of their bodies praying, in that way strengthening their spirituality. I quote the closing paragraph of her essay. "Yet now I approach my domestic labor differently. While I used to consider the work that I needed to do around the house utterly expendable, I now see it as an integral part for my and my family's happiness. Through my body's daily offering, I bear witness to the belief that my private sphere is just as worthy of my attention as my public sphere, and that my inner life is just as worthy as my care and labor as my outer life. And with each sock I put away, I trust that a sacred alchemy is unfurling." So why do we see toil that is physical, demanding, repetitive, and apparently boring as always meaningless and undesirable? The story of Sisyphus is usually presented in this light. Sisyphus, a figure of Greek mythology who angered the gods, was condemned to repeat forever the same meaningless task of pushing up a boulder up a mountain, only to see it roll down again just as it nears the top. What a rotten fate Sisyphus had. Yet Albert Camus, the great French absurdist writer, had a more nuanced and hopeful perspective on Sisyphus and his fate in his essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, published in 1942. Consider that Sisyphus, above all, has a task. It is his own. Rather than a source of despair, it may enable a state of contented acceptance, if not the beginning of happiness. Camus' essay concludes, "This universe henceforth without a master seems to Sisyphus neither sterile nor futile. Each atom of that stone, each mineral flake of that night-filled mountain, in itself forms a world. The struggle itself towards the heights is enough to fill a man's heart. One must imagine Sisyphus happy." Let's conclude with Roger Cohn's final thoughts to the young graduates on this happiness business. They are relevant, I think, to all of us. "No success, however glittering, that denies yourself will make you happy in the long run. So listen to the voice from your soul, quiet but insistent, and honor it. Find what you thrill to, if not the perfect sentence, the beautiful cure, the brilliant formula, the lovely chord, the exquisite sauce, the artful reconciliation. Strive not for everything money can buy, but for everything money can't buy." Amen. We will now have our third hymn, number 83, "Winds Be Still." And after that, the offertory will be collected. Our notices. Tea and coffee are served below in the Damer Hall after the service. All are very welcome, particularly if you are a visitor. We would love to see you downstairs. Pam McCarthy leads a weekly service of reflection in the church every Wednesday from 1:05 to 1:35. These sessions can be accessed live on our webcam. Streaming begins at 1 o'clock. It can be a quiet and aspiring time in the middle of your week. The book club meets on the last Wednesday of the month at 7:30 in the vestry of the church. The next meeting will be in January, and suggested reading for December is Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. The walking club's next outing is on Saturday, the 17th of January. It's a walk from Dunleary to Killiney, a loop walk. The December edition of Uskult, our church magazine, can be found on the table at the entrance. And please take up a copy. It's wonderful reading material. We are collecting, on behalf of the Capuchin Day Centre, we are collecting children's pyjamas, hats and scarves. And also there is the possibility for you to donate vouchers for Smith's toy stores up to a maximum of €40. So perhaps €5 or €10, whatever you can afford. But the main thing here is that the deadline is seven days away. It really has to be all brought into the church by the 7th of December. Our carol service will be on Sunday, the 14th of December this year. After the service, we will have a raffle. The proceeds will go to charity. We will also be selling tree decorations, jams, chutneys. If you wish to contribute or volunteer, please contact Alison. The next notice is slightly procedural, but it's an indication of how in Unitarian churches it's done democratically. And the Synod of Munster has called an extraordinary general meeting of the Congregation of the Unitarian Church in Prince Street, Cork, to be held in the vestry of St. Stephen's Green Unitarian Church at 11 a.m. on Saturday, the 6th of December, for the following purposes. The appointment of the following individuals as trustees of the Cork Unitarian Church building in Prince Street, Cork. Mr. Rory Delaney, Ms. Pamela McCarthy, and Mr. Anthony Brady. The meeting will be asked to accept and note the resignation of Mr. Dennis Aylmer as trustee. The trustee company of the non-subscribing Presbyterian Church will continue to act as trustees of the Cork Church building. A short service will be held after the meeting. So finally, can I give a word of thanks to the many members of the congregation who made this service possible. Josh for his wonderful music, and Doreen for that delightful contribution from yourself. Alison for her reading, Margaret for the lovely flowers, our welcomer Peter upstairs and Dirren downstairs, to the tea and coffee crew who will be providing the drinks below, and of course to Ayla, guardian of the church, who ensures that all logistics run smoothly and service givers don't fall over. Our last hymn is a congregation favourite, Come Sing a Song with Me, number 346. May the light around us guide our footsteps and hold us fast to the best and most righteous that we seek. May the darkness around us nurture our dreams and give us rest so that we may give ourselves to the work of our world. Let us seek to remember the wholeness of our lives, the weaving of light and shadow. In this great and astonishing dance in which we move. Amen.